This is A Coastal Story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. It was a hot summer, 1929. A long one, too. Even in September, people were still heading to the coast in large numbers to feel the breeze on their skin and the sand between their toes. Eastbourne was particularly busy, which for the people who ran Eastbourne was a good thing, but one that came with a few issues. The East Sussex Resort had always rather fancied itself. A refuge for the refined, summer for the swanks, leisure pursuits for the landed. Winston Churchill had holidayed there. So had Edward Elgar and Charlie Chaplin. Claude Debussy had holed up in the Grand Hotel in 1904 and finished composing La Mer in a room with a view of the English Channel. This was the sort of person Eastbourne liked to attract. No matter that Debussy was kind of on the run, having abandoned his wife and skipped the country with his mistress. A great composer had chosen Eastbourne, and that was all you needed to know. Things were changing in the 1920s, and those changes were arriving even in sleepy Eastbourne. Improved working conditions, paid holidays, and an affordable, efficient transport network opened up the coast to a larger cross-section of the population, many of whom began turning up in Eastbourne. These days we think nothing of parking ourselves on a beach, stripping down to our swimwear and settling in for the day. Occasionally we'll go for a splash about in the sea or stick on a pair of flip-flops and wander up the town searching for a bag of chips or a calipo. Whether we're trying to win a Pokemon rubber on the Penny Falls or filling our face with whelks, our time is our own and there's no one to judge. Mostly because everyone else is in beachwear as ridiculous as ours and doing the same things. Things were different a century ago. Strange as it sounds today, in many places up until the 1920s you were expected to pay to go in the sea. A combination of avarice and Victorian decorum had it that access to the briny was via the bathing carriages lined up on the shore, rolling back and forth, disgorging their occupants into the waves without the risk of passers-by catching a scandalous glimpse of a goose-pimply calf. By the end of the 1920s, bathing carriages were dying out in many resorts, but Eastbourne still had them. In 1929, it was eightpence to rent one for half an hour, and an extra tuppence to hire a towel. Add in a tip for the attendant, and you were looking at a shilling every time you fancied a dip. Not everyone had a shilling a day, and that was per person. For a family of four, that's over £1 on bathing alone for your week's holiday. That's the equivalent of nearly 70 quid today. In fact, that's pretty much how the tradition of going for a paddle developed. It was a working class thing. If you removed your shoes and socks and rolled up your trouser legs, it was a way of enjoying the sea without disrobing in front of snobs and without risking a ticking off from council inspectors. Most importantly, it was free. Even if you could justify the cost of a bathing carriage, there were the queues to consider. In hot summers like 1929, the world and his wife, or indeed mistress, would be crowding the promenades, and you could expect a queue for up to an hour for a machine. On less busy days, you could still wait a good 20 minutes. Then there were the contraptions themselves, pretty ancient by 1929, some of them dating way back into the Victorian age. People complained that they were dirty, damp, airless, and smelt pretty unpleasant. As a correspondent to the Eastbourne Gazette that summer put it, signing himself Hardened Bather, "I regret to say some bathers have filthy habits, in a way it is more decent to imagine than describe." Not all resorts were as strict as Eastbourne. Some, like Bognor Regis further along the coast, tolerated what was called Macintosh bathing, an increasingly popular practice by which a bather would change into their costume at their hotel or boarding house, put on a Macintosh, walk to the sea, slip off the raincoat, and take the waters at their leisure. hardened bather himself, often enjoyed this practice in Bognor. Not only that, he said that once he'd come out of the sea and put on his Macintosh, he could then enjoy an hour's sunbathe without some dog's body trying to move him on. Eastbourne, like many other hoity-toity resorts, strongly disapproved of this vulgar practice. Anyone caught Macintosh bathing in Eastbourne could expect to find a council official waiting by the discarded coat, ready to issue them with a sharp reprimand. There were bylaws, you see. The risk of Eastbourne's more refined visitors biting through their pipe stems and glaring through lorgnettes at the sight of ankles being flaunted yards from the sea couldn't be countenanced. And people just lying around the beach belted into raincoats until they were lightly poached as if they owned the place? Not in Eastbourne, matey. To be fair, loads of people lying around the shore in raincoats would look a bit weird, as if a shipload of spies had sunk in the channel or something and they'd just crawled ashore. Also, of course, Macintosh bathing meant the bathing machines were missing out on their slice of the action. In the summer of 1928, 163,000 people had paid to use the Eastbourne Corporation machines, and 35,000 towels were hired, bringing in a cool £5,300. That's more than £300,000 today, and almost double the profit from the previous summer. With the queues for the machines growing ever longer, bathers getting increasingly disgruntled, and corporation attendants prowling the shore for errant rainwear, as the summer of 1929 produced a late heatwave, issues that had simmered for weeks came to a head. Something had to happen, and on September the 13th, it did. Class war came to Eastbourne. It was a gloriously sunny day. A turquoise sea sparkled beneath a cloudless, cornflower blue sky, and the crowds were out early on the promenade, and lines began to form at the bathing machines from early in the morning. Yet, there was a definite tension in the air, like a storm was about to break. Around lunchtime, from the back of the beach came a hubbub that turned into a commotion that became a brouhaha. Promenaders stopped promenading. People queuing for the machines craned their necks to see what was happening. Deck chair snoozers were elbowed in the ribs and told to look. Onto the beach strode a group of men and women 150 strong, making purposefully for the sea. They were clad in Macintoshes. There was even the odd bathrobe. As the crowds parted to let them through, it was like the Red Sea with Moses wearing a Mac. On reaching the shore, they unbelted their garments as one, dropped them onto the beach, and walked into the water without so much as a glance behind them. As a flurry of bewildered council officials and the odd policemen scurried after them, the protesters had the cheek to start enjoying themselves. They splashed. They whooped. They laughed. This kind of thing wasn't on. Not in Eastbourne. When these Bolsheviks of bathing began to emerge dripping and happy from the water, they were accosted by corporation officials demanding their names and addresses. Their conduct, they were told, was common and not respectable, and they would receive an official letter of reprimand. Policemen stood at their shoulders, nodding sternly. "We don't want Eastbourne becoming another Brighton," one protester was told. The militant bathers caused a sensation that made the national press. It was called a strike, a rebellion, a rumpus, an act of mass disobedience. And most of the country backed the protesters. A.P. Herbert of the Daily Mail responded to the Brighton comment by writing, "There is more life and amusement in a square mile of Brighton than there is in the whole of Eastbourne. And Brighton has nothing to be ashamed of. The name of Eastbourne should stink in the nostrils of holidaymakers until Eastbourne's governors are changed." Eastbourne's governors tried to defend themselves. They'd probably never been called stinky before. Councillor Wheeler, chair of the Entertainments Committee, said, "We do not wish to be vindictive, but we will not have our authority flouted." Which is just the kind of happy-go-lucky joie de vivre you look for in a man in charge of entertainment. The Raincoat Rebellion made the front pages of both the Eastbourne Herald and the Eastbourne Gazette. "Surely Eastbourne has already suffered enough," cried the Gazette after 5 days in the national spotlight. You get an idea of just how shocking the Bathers' Rebellion was for Eastbourne from that edition of the Gazette. Alongside the report of the incident was a story headlined, "Dog snaps at policeman and tears his trousers." That's on the front page, remember. On the letters page, one correspondent complained that the town's milkmen were too noisy when making deliveries, citing the unnecessary banging together of empty milk bottles. Another wrote in to say he'd waited half an hour for a bus. With Eastbourne, clanking milk bottles and all, suddenly the flashpoint of social revolution, the corporation couldn't win. They weren't the only town to have banned Mackintosh bathing, but they were probably the snootiest, and were unfortunate enough to become the national focus for a major change in how Britain went on holiday. The following summer, Mackintosh bathing was widely permitted, and in some resorts, actively encouraged. By 1932, almost all charges and restrictions had disappeared across the country. Eastbourne, docile, prissy Eastbourne, adapted as it needed to, and remains a popular and classy destination to this day. The Bathers' Rebellion is all but forgotten now, and it's hard to appreciate the sensation and shift in social mores it provoked in 1929. It was enough even to be commemorated in verse, with a poem published in newspapers and periodicals across the nation. "Ye visitors to Eastbourne, who bathe in pleasant seas, lift high the noble standard that guards your liberties. Go forth in solid phalanx, assert your native right. Though the battle rages loud and long, go boldly to the fight. A purblind corporation demands a wretched fee and blocks the way to bathers who seek the morning sea. In numbers overwhelming, assault the frowning keep. Sweep obstacles like bubbles before you to the deep. The meteor flag of bathers shall yet terrific burn, and the haughty foe shall be laid low, and the star of peace return." That was a coastal story. I'm Charlie Connolly. There is a Coastal Stories page on Facebook if you search for Coastal Stories Podcast. You don't have to pay 8 shillings and climb into a whiffy wooden truck to access it either. You can find me on Twitter at Charlie Connolly, and my next book, The Channel, will be published in the summer by Orion. But you can pre-order it now, if you like. The waves you can hear were recorded at Deal on February the 13th, 2020, in the small window between Storms Kira and Dennis.